Welcome back to Irish Illustrated Insider. It is Thursday, June 11th. I'm Tim O'Malley, joined today by John Bryce of USA Today, Drew Mentock of Irish Illustrated. Guys, we filmed on Monday. The little podcast jinx came back, I guess, because the biggest news in the college football offseason, and I guarantee you it will continue to be the biggest news in the college football offseason, happened during our last podcast when Texas Tech quarterback Brendan Sorsby was granted a temporary injunction that could clear him to play for Texas Tech in 2026, despite being declared ineligible for waging on college sports, college football, and his own team. John Bryce, I'm not sure if you've heard anything about this story or not, or if it's come across your desk at USA Today, but if not, I could catch you up on it real fast.
Oh, I've heard way too much about this story. I feel like all I'm doing right now is the Protect College Sports Act, Brendan Sorsby and the College Sports Commission and NIL and associated entities and MMRs and all of this other stuff that means I still haven't written from my sit down with Kalani Sitake, who, by the way, I will share some news that will hype up the Notre Dame faithful. He told me point blank he thinks Notre Dame will be the number one team in the country going into the season, expressed great respect for them, and had talked about visiting some in the past with Marcus Freeman. And so, you know, continue to be super impressed with Kalani Sitake and enjoyed my time there. Brendan Sorsby, I don't know if I'm jumping out of order here. We have a tendency to do that. But there was a question that said, describe it in reaction in one word. And so I'm going to give you this one. Farcical. So there you go. Farcical, and you can see that one word definitely starts with an F, but stunned. I'm working on it today because the Big 12 is supposed to have another call with kind of its executive leadership throughout the conference today to discuss things. I actually spoke with an attorney. His publicist had reached out earlier in the week. Then it turned out we have mutual friends because even though he's Phoenix-based, he is a Notre Dame attorney or a Notre Dame grad, Ryan Regula. And I spoke with him yesterday about it, and he helped explain how it's contract law. That's what they're leaning on. That's how the judge has superseded the NCAA's rules and found that Sorsby is now eligible to play. He cautioned that he expects this to be much more common moving forward, pending the outcome of this ultimate case on appeal and just sort of some of the other layers. Again, more coverage that I'll have at USA Today, but it's ridiculous. I'm talking with multiple coaches and staffs in the Big 12 right now, even during this podcast, and people are just furious. It's the one cardinal rule that is inviolate in sports, and you shouldn't get to play. And I'll just remind, maybe he did have an anxiety disorder, a gambling addiction. I would remind he never sought help until he found out he was under investigation. Texas Tech never put him in help until he found out he was under investigation. And again, it was an openly known secret at Cincinnati that he was gambling. No, I know the pizza spot that he was going to in Cincinnati and routinely gambling with his teammates because they had an NIL deal with Cincinnati Athletics.
I guess my word, if we're going there, is catalyst. I just feel like this is, it might sound strange, but I feel like this is something that will kind of unite a lot of people and finally maybe start making stuff happen. And I feel like we've seen a lot of change and different things going on in college football. And I guess I just feel this is something that people are so clearly united on that they think is wrong, and people are starting to look at some pretty dramatic options. We'll see if that actually happens. But even in terms of the Protect College Sports Act and stuff like that, I'm curious if this is something that is a uniting force and maybe getting some things done. But I just feel like obviously a lot of people have turned on Texas Tech, and even, I mean, senators in that state, like Ted Cruz is the person who co-sponsored that bill. Another one is a lame duck senator. He doesn't have anyone to approve either. So even in their own state, it's going to be easy to potentially oppose this if they want to.
You know, there's almost no ruling that would come across that I would even blink without thinking, well, that's of course going to happen. And people are, whatever money works is going to get everybody eligible here. But this is the only one I think I've ever seen. It was like, wait, what? That seemed impossible to me that would happen. I heard a really good point on the Danny Cannell, Dusty Dvorak show. And JB, as you pointed out, you know, he wasn't seeking help until he was being investigated. The real key is, like, college football is not where you receive therapy. That's not part of your therapy. That is, if he was not that good, and if their backup quarterback was healthy, Will Hammond was hurt last year. If their backup quarterback was Rayola, who decided to go instead to Oregon, if their backup quarterback was Kenny Minchie, you wouldn't be fighting this as much. That's the reality of this situation. If your backup quarterback was Kenny Minchie, you wouldn't care. You wouldn't be going through this as Texas Tech. And the other point was, if he, so he's, you know, he's really struggling with this. I'm sure he is. Is he going to be practicing? Do you practice football? Is that probably, like, cause he could be all part of the summer workouts, or does he have to be somewhere to really take care of his mental health? I bet he's practicing. I bet he's involved in football activities.
Yeah. That's a great question. One, Joy, I like Joy McGuire. I've gotten to know him a little bit through the years from my time at Football Scoop. He's a coach that, if I'm not mistaken, reached out to me when my dad passed away. So, you know, I have some forever gratitude for that. I thought his comments yesterday were absolutely atrocious, and I understand he's in a no-win situation, but you should not bring up how sports has given second chance to people who have beaten up other people, or that sports has been an avenue for a second chance for saying it's not like he murdered someone. Like, just don't even go there. That was so poor. And I had somebody way smarter than me this morning text me and say, can we not get some PR help for Texas Tech? And this was a Notre Dame fan saying it, just so cringed by all of this. And
maybe it seems like that's I want to just, on your point, it seems like this is their PR move. Like, their billionaire boosters said the same thing today. This seems like this is the PR plan, which is a terrible idea.
Well, look, we've been talking about salaries for weeks, and I had an SEC person reach out to me earlier this week and say, you know, he's just one player in the game of football. It's not like a Wembanyama or a LeBron or a Michael Jordan or a Kobe in basketball, where he's that seminal to what you're doing. At what point do you say it's not worth the squeeze? And I said, well, no, like, I would consider this as the counter argument. Texas Tech has roughly 70 to 75 million invested just in this coming season, based on everything we know from a public standpoint on coaches' salaries, Joy McGuire's rework deals, the assistants making more than ever, James Blanchard's new deal, all of this. I've shared before that I've been told by multiple people, including those who recruited Sorsby out of the portal, that he was going to make $5 million at LSU. And Texas Tech came along and blew that offer out of the water. Texas Tech is one of those programs I've alluded to that I've been told adamantly by enough different people who don't talk to each other, who don't know each other, their salary or their payroll for this upcoming season is projected at over $50 million. So I get why Texas Tech, from that standpoint, is like, we're all in because we've been all in on this year, and we have to be all in on this year. And maybe he's only one player and $6.5 million-ish of what they have invested, but he's a linchpin in that. And, you know, Texas Tech played for the College World Series softball title last week because it adopted a mercenary approach. And, you know, I said a few weeks ago, my hot take would be that Notre Dame would be college football's villain. No, this will be, this Texas Tech team is shaping up to be an amalgamation of the Pony Express and the Bad Boy Hurricanes. Like, combine them and combine the hatred and vitriol, and that's what they will be.
Then we had a question from Wash ND that's related to this, and he asked, have you ever seen an entire world of college football turn on a team, such as what we've seen after the Sorsby ruling? They seem to have become the most hated team in the sport overnight. Do you think it's possible that they could be blackballed from the college football playoff if they don't win the Big 12? And I want to throw onto that, do you think, not that this matters anymore, except they can set a precedent for 2.5 months, do you think AP voters will vote for Texas A&M? Or excuse me, for Texas Tech?
I think they will. Overall, you might have a few that abstain, but I think that overall they will. I've tried to ask that legal question about, could the CFP exclude them either overtly or tacitly? And I get the impression that that's a legal avenue that would be pretty perilous. And because, again, as the attorney Ryan Regula pointed out to me, even though the judge's order on Monday and giving Sorsby the temporary injunction was relatively brief, he pointed to maybe page 3. There's a clause in there where the judge enjoins the NCAA from enforcing its restitution law, which means that not only is Texas Tech protected by, not only is he granted the injunctive relief and right now eligible to play, but the judge's order makes it to where the NCAA can't go and vacate wins if Sorsby plays and later loses. He makes it to where that, and he pointed this out to me, which I would have eventually liked to think I would have thought of, but he noted it immediately. It also means, most importantly, the NCAA can't go and claw back television money if Sorsby loses the injunctive relief on the NCAA's appeal, even if it's in February of next year. So most legal people think the NCAA will see it through to its end no matter what because of the precedent involved. And I'll have more on what NCAA legal arguments may be in their case against Sorsby. But it sure sounds like some of this stuff that people are throwing out there just isn't going to be a pragmatic option.
Brandon Sorsby needs help with his addiction. Texas Tech would not be the ones helping him as of now if they had a great backup quarterback. That's my last thought on this matter. It wouldn't be as big of a deal to Texas Tech that he needs help with his addiction. He would still need help with his addiction, but Texas Tech wouldn't care if they were stepping in with a great backup quarterback.
That segment was brought to you by BetTO.
We were going to start with some positive news about Notre Dame football that I believe Adam Rittenberg from ESPN does a now annual future power rankings. And very wisely, he does a 2-year future power ranking because this sport cannot go past 2 years when you're trying to power rank anything. Notre Dame came in number one, Drew Mentock, jumping ahead of Ohio State, Texas, and Oregon and Georgia. Was Notre Dame fifth last year? I believe you wrote,
yes.
Wrote this up. So Ohio State 2, Texas 3, Oregon 4, Georgia 5, the Miami Hurricanes 6, Indiana 7. No one's had a greater rise in the future power rankings in the history of the future power rankings than Indiana over the last few years. Notre Dame number one, Drew. Thanks. That was a fun June read. And I like the way he does it. I think it's hard to know everything about all these teams, but you can actually make the argument for Notre Dame over a 2-year period.
Yeah. And we've all seen Adam. He comes to at least a couple practices or media events or press conferences every year. So he's somebody who's definitely, I think he's based in Chicago, familiar with Notre Dame pretty well too. But I do think a little bit of Notre Dame withstanding all the NFL interest from Marcus Freeman, keeping that continuity, having their coordinators come back. And I do think he, even though he alluded to they do have Teddy Girard and Noah Groves, I do think maybe around Notre Dame, or at least around us, we see CJ Carrs, there's a good chance he's gone after this year. I don't know if that's his perception or the perception nationally. So I do think that's part of the ranking too, is that they think Notre Dame could has continuity at the coaching position and then could have, one of the best quarterbacks in the country, not just for this year, but the next 2 years too. And to your point too, I think he used to do the power rankings for a greater amount of time, but obviously now with the transfer portal and stuff, it's so difficult to predict. So just the next 2 seasons, but it is an interesting look at just on how far and how healthy the perception of Notre Dame is from a recruiting perspective, what they show they can do in the transfer portal and developing the talent they get there too.
And honestly, guys, other than Raiola with Oregon, you figure Saiyan, Arch Manning, CJ Carr, Dante Moore, obviously, Mensa, those guys are all probably leaving. That's a path to the NFL for all those quarterbacks. So it's, you got to kind of treat it as weighing this year and then next year, even though this will affect JB's delicate sensibilities. If it happens, Notre Dame could go out and get the second best quarterback in the transfer portal, JB.
Oh, yes. I would be most highly offended by that. No, I read Adam's stuff. He is Chicago-based, super good dude. I like Adam a lot. Found it very interesting. I do think it's a testament to stability, not just Marcus Freeman, but also keeping all three coordinators. My former colleague, Zach Barnett, I think, has a story out at Football Scoop about how many teams in FBS held on to their head coach and just their offensive and defensive coordinators. And it's not a super voluminous list. So yeah, Notre Dame's in a great spot. They're recruiting at an unreal level. Pete Sampson wrote about it. We've talked about it. They're spending at a major level and they're well positioned.
The recruiting news, kind of. 2028, Notre Dame's first pledge. They did get a kicker. So if possible, if Micah Davies can, or excuse me, Owen Micah Davies, if Owen Davies can beat out Micah Drescher and the next Spencer Porath, who will be gone by the time he is on campus, from the transfer portal, then this is big recruiting news. But man, I am on the total bandwagon, and I think you guys would agree with me. You find your kicker is the best available kicker in the transfer portal every year. And if your freshman happens to be better, that's fine. But Notre Dame should continue to go down the, I believe this for nickel too, except they're so stacked. But kicker and punter, get the best one if you're Notre Dame.
Yeah, I agree. And Davies, he's the number two kicker in his class, according to Kohl's, which ranks specialist. So I think that means something, but obviously you can have a really powerful leg or do well in those camps. But until you get in front of 75,000 fans and show you can make a 45 yarder under pressure and stuff, that's really what it comes down to when it comes to college. So this is definitely, you know, it's good to get those guys on campus and see if you can develop. But I agree, it doesn't mean he's going to be Notre Dame's kicker in 3 or 4 years.
2 years of Spencer Porath anyway, right, JP?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, extended time for Scaife as well. But look, we've been alluding to this for weeks. I'd said that the Notre Dame specialist camp from a couple of weeks ago was a tremendous success and expect some residual positive news out of it. So this has been in the works for a while. I think there is something to be said for identifying a guy going into the absolute heart of SEC country in the state of Tennessee and getting a guy from a program that has produced a lot of Division I players and specifically a lot of Division I kickers. And, you know, if you can save Marty Biagi from having to fly halfway around the world to Australia, maybe that $12,000 flight goes into rev share.
We'll be back with a Sorsby-free segment two, burning up the boards, but we might talk gambling just to be hypocritical, just like the NCAA.
I bet we do.
Welcome back to segment two, burning up the boards. Our first question is a related two-parter. First, from Insane ND Tucson, is there a player outside the projected two deep that could ascend and make an impact this season on either side of the ball? And Wash ND with a similar question with some historical context. Every year under Freeman, a player who did not start at the beginning of the season became not only a starter, but one of the best players on that side of the ball. Morrison in 22, John Baptiste in 23, Moore in 24, Tay Johnson in 25. Who is that player in 26? And guys, the latter part does not have to be outside the two deep, but the outside the two deep is a really interesting thing on a stacked roster.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we're looking at outside the two deep for most of what we saw this spring, I would probably go Devin Fitzgerald at this point. I don't know if Madden Framo counts as outside, just because if everyone was healthy, maybe he technically wouldn't be in that. But I mean, Devin Fitzgerald just seems to really be coming on. I think his progression over not just even since he's been on campus, but even his going into his senior year, all the effort he's putting in has really been paying off. And I think he does a lot of special things. Ian Premer was the other one I kind of wrote down because he's not on campus yet. But
yeah, I struggled with this one a fair amount. I like Fitzgerald. I've tried to think on the defensive side of the ball, you know, is where is Iwatade? That would probably be a guy that I think can be a real factor that's probably not right now in the two deep. So I think that's who I would go with. And then, you know, if there's if you're two deep right now is Aeneas Williams and Nolan James, then it's pretty established that I'm bullish on those two young running backs, probably especially Jonas Walton.
Yeah, I think outside the two deep, I have to go receiver because the two deep is kind of murky. We don't know who they are. They should be a good player, but Fitzgerald, even Elijah Burris to make an impact. If you're Bubba Frazier, maybe, but there's so many good slots. If you're going to go way outside the box, Kerry Adams was my guy. I feel like if he played, didn't have the surgery and played in the spring, he would be on the cusp of, he might be on the two deep now. And I, you know, he needs an it. Obviously, you don't want to talk about injuries, but he needs an injury to get in. But that's how Leonard Moore got in. Leonard Moore got in because of an injury. That's Benjamin Morrison just won a job, basically. But Notre Dame did not have the corners when Benjamin Morrison won that job, but they do now. So he beat out, he just took Clarence Lewis off the field for a little while. That's not the same thing. As opposed to a guy that doesn't start that could become a best player, that's a small list, but I went with Quincy Porter because he might not start to start the year. And then guys like Keeley and Jaden Sanders, simply because they're going to be 1Bs to the starters. Jaden Sanders looks really good. But once again, there's a lot of competition. Next question is from Clear Screen 25. Could you explain what is meant by scout team, prep team, etc., including how they decide who those players are, what is considered promotion or demotion, and what they work on compared to the first and second teams. And just very quickly, scout team and prep team are basically interchangeable words coaches use.
Yeah. I mean, scout team, prep team,
show team, those are all the same.
Yeah. Yeah. Show team is a really popular new term for it.
It's like throw game. Show team is the throw game of scout teams.
You know, if you're a quarterback and you're being asked to run that unit, then I don't think that's a really bad thing, especially if you're running it week in and week out for some of the most important opponents of the year. But also, like, Notre Dame has done such a great job under Marcus Freeman, especially the past 2 years and moving on into this year, where they're able to two spot every practice, as we've talked about at length, which means they're basically doubling the amount of practice reps that they get. Rather than having a bunch of guys standing around, they're basically running simultaneous full practices on the two outdoor practice fields with, you know, 45 guys on each field or 50 guys on each field, so that they're constantly getting reps and rotating through. So, you know, you can move up off scout team and find a spot in the regular squad practice, and that means you're going to probably be on the travel roster and have a great chance of playing in the whatever ensuing following game of that week. With the exception of the quarterback, a lot of times they still travel all the quarterbacks on the road, even if they're on an unofficial de facto redshirt plan. I hopefully explain that relatively decently.
Yeah, I guess from an individual basis, I guess the biggest thing is if you're on the scout team, you're going to be spending more time running the other team's plays or what they've scouted for them, rather than working on Notre Dame's specific game plan for that team too. So you're definitely less prepared to go into that game because you're spending more time getting the people who will play prepared.
And for the process, basically, roughly 2 weeks into camp, they decide varsity and scout team. That way, the scout team can prepare the varsity for games for 2 weeks and for the rest of the season. CJ Carr obviously famously did run some scout team as a freshman because he was injured scout teams as a freshman. So we do know that. I believe Tay Johnson came back from injury on scout team for a little bit as a freshman that same year, 2024. He ended up being elevated to the varsity because he was on the two deep. Super Jordan Faison started on the scout team until he was absolutely necessary in 2023, because they weren't planning on playing him. I don't remember where we were, but I was talking to Tommy Reese. We asked him, again, recruiting wasn't as good. He said he was never on a scout team at Notre Dame except when he was suspended for that Navy game. That was the only time when he had to run the scout team. So I think most quarterbacks end up on the scout team at some point, if you consider CJ Carden, maybe not Jimmy Clausen, because by the time he was there, there was nobody that was going to push him to the scout team. But a lot of guys spend time on the scout team. It is a demotion. You want to make the varsity. There's no other way of saying it, but they have to have conversations, I'm sure. And I think offensive and defensive linemen understand you may end up on the scout team as a true freshman.
Yeah. I wouldn't call it a demotion if you're a freshman or sophomore.
No,
it's a rite of passage. If you're a junior or a senior and you're being told, then, you know, you're probably also Googling what the exact transfer portal dates are in December.
Yeah, that's why a guy like Brennan Vernon is so unselfish. Like, not only was he put on the scout team, he started playing scout team on the other side of scrimmage to help out Notre Dame. They have a couple guys like that. Obviously, Freeman pointed them out last year, Drew.
Yeah, and I think if you're a younger guy too, it can be better for your development to go against those first teamers in practice and see what they're doing. Obviously, you want to be part of the game plan. That would be better, but you're getting reps and seeing what you have to do to go against the best that Notre Dame has to offer. So it's not like you're wasting that time in practice either.
I do think you'd be careful too, JB, like a very highly touted player. Let's just use Kerry Adams again, since I gave him the highest compliment already. Let's say he's third string corner coming out of August 14th. Well, that guy playing scout team corner can earn his way off scout team pretty damn quickly when you're that talented. You're not just a body out there for Jordan Faison to run by. You might mess up some people.
Yeah, no, and we've alluded to that, and Marcus Freeman was doing scout team players of the week, and then he, I think, decided that didn't kind of fit the, you know, team glory mantra as much, even though I thought that was a great way to shine a spotlight on some guys who otherwise wouldn't be considered part of the team glory or thought about from the general public as part of the team glory. But you're right. You can go out there and you have to be careful that you're not reckless against your quote unquote starting teammates, but you can go out there and earn the coach's attention and change your roster designation and change where you fall on things. It's kind of like I've told recruits through the years or their parents, if they've reached out to me about going to a camp, and I've unabashedly said, steal reps, cut line, do it all the time. You can do the similar stuff on the scout team practice field and get the coach's notice.
My last thing to that point too is Marcus Freeman has historically been heavily involved with the scout team and running that. So that is a good time to get in front of, he's going to be paying attention to you because he's really helping with that game plan and especially in practice. Our next question is from Candy Irish. A, did you watch the entire Knicks game? And B, when did you figure out they'd win?
I watched the entire game if you count, like, you know, I turned off some of the third quarter to flip channels, but I was flipping back and forth. I figured that they would make this a real game when it was near the end of the third quarter and it was 17. And the announcers were saying, you got to get a 2-for-1. And I thought, I don't think you need to get a 2-for-1. I just think you need to score here and pressure them to 15 points or so. That's half the lead you had, man. And you know they're going to start getting nervous in that fourth quarter. And my God, did they get nervous. But boy, were they incredibly stupid, JB. I will turn it over to you. And I want to point out something. It is fascinating that teams can't avoid shooting threes, even when you miss on 8 straight possessions up 20 points. Quit shooting threes.
The football equivalent, I guess, would be to be closing in on the third quarter with a 21-point lead in football and decide that you're still going to run an air raid tempo offense. Yeah. Like that to me is what the Spurs did. They showed no patience. They showed absolutely zero basketball IQ. I know that this question is from Candy Irish. There were some Candy A plays made. That's for darn sure. I did watch the entire game. My wife, as I think it's known on this podcast, is a massive basketball fan, and we've gone to a few Jazz games before their season unceremoniously ended during our time out here in Utah. So I used to be a massive NBA fan. I still like watching the playoffs, not as good as NHL playoffs. The only time I switched away was to finish watching my Braves lose the second game in a row to the first place Chicago White Sox. Shout out to friend of the program, Malloy on base. He's a Sox fan. They're now in first place. They've taken the first two from the Braves. I thought that San Antonio was going to win when the Knicks got it to like a 12-point game with maybe 7:59 to go in the game. They're the home team. The arena was absolutely crazy town, banana land, and you could just sense that like a 12-point lead in the NBA, we see it erased inside the final 4 minutes. In that setting, the way the momentum was going, when the Spurs had scored, 40 points in the first quarter and didn't score 40 points the entire second half, scored 30 points, I think, the entire second half. Like,
right.
You just knew. So I don't have a real strong rooting interest in it, but I sort of like watching all the Knicks celebrity fans in anguish. So I was very disappointed at how much they got to celebrate, even though I love Seinfeld. So,
well, Pete Sampson sent me a tweet. It wasn't his tweet, but Sampson forwarded me this tweet. It was a picture of Seinfeld, and it said, the Spurs know how to take a lead. They just don't know how to hold a lead. That's one of the better was also, I'm sorry, Drew, I was cutting you off. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, for opposite reasons, I really just am rooting against the Spurs. I don't want them. I don't mind Wembanyama. I just don't want him to achieve a championship this early. Like, he needs to struggle a little bit more. I feel like he's so dominant, and I don't want him to. He's not going to be like Shaq, where he shows up to training camp 70 pounds overweight and kind of ruins his career. I feel like he's going to have his dominance. So when I saw they're up by 23 points or whatever it was in the first, I turned it off because I just didn't want to see a Spurs victory. And obviously, I regretted that when I looked on Twitter before bed and saw that they'd come back.
Even though you're not wearing your cycling jersey today, I want to thank you for clearly riding in from yelling at the clouds to join us for this podcast today. Can't believe you're such a hater towards Wembanyama. Gone and spent a summer with the monks and whatever else he's done. You know, be a hater of De'Aaron Fox, another guy making dumb decisions in the NBA after playing point guard for John Calipari at Kentucky. But come on now. Nah, that was
the DraftKings player of the game.
Yeah, there you go. There's another winning wager for me. So with that, we can move on to question number four. And it is from Jeff Allwine. Summertime question. Jumping out of a pool has been a talked about impressive athletic feat. What is the most impressive random feat you have seen a player achieve? How about yourself or a friend? T.O., let's start with you. I feel like you probably dunked in a bookstore basketball.
No. My greatest athletic feat ever was in high school driver's ed class. I was at the end of the hallway, and I needed a nickel, 45 cents, to buy a Mountain Dew. And my friend threw the nickel all the way down the hallway. It bounced once. I hit it with my knee up in the air, and I caught it with my fingertips and put it in all in one fell swoop. That is the most athletic thing I have ever done in my life. No one can repeat it. I, just like Jerry Seinfeld, when people say, can you do it again? I choose not to run. I choose not to show that skill off ever again. Number one. Try it sometime. Have someone throw a nickel 50 feet down a hallway to you. Catch it and put it in the... Are there pop machines anymore? I don't know, but there you go.
All right. Well, next time we're in the IAC, we're going to test that. I think in terms of Notre Dame players, I mean, Grayson McKeough doing a backflip at 6'7", 260, 70 pounds. And according to him, he could still do it. They just told him he now weighs 300 pounds and he should not attempt that anymore. So I think in terms of random feat by a player, I guess also Jeremiah Love doing his first ever hurdle in a game and learning that's how he could do it. I know that's not random football feat, but like, it's not like he had tried that before. And he's a guy who's pretty methodical and working on spin moves while he's waiting in line to do drills. So the fact that somebody who works like that just randomly did a feat is pretty crazy too.
Do you have your own athletic feat? You're a baseball player. You played in competitive wiffle ball tournaments. There has to be something.
That's true. I mean, I used to be able to dunk, but every time I tried it in a pickup game, I always missed and embarrassed myself. So that was good. Last summer, since we referenced cycling, we did go to a stage of the Tour de France and we hiked up Mount Ventoux and we were terrible at planning and we thought it was silly. Everybody was biking up this steep climb and then we didn't realize it until going down would be substantially easier. So I think we started in like a little town called Bedouin and we ended up hiking like 33, 34 miles that day, mostly up and down one of the steepest climbs in the Tour, and we were dead. So I think just in terms of endurance and recency bias, that might be my most impressive recent feat.
Did you catch a nickel while you're doing it, though?
No. I couldn't have.
If not mistaken, I think McKeough told you or me or both of us that actually his last backflip, he was at 285.
Oh, yes, right.
Which prompts the second Crazy Town Banana Land reference in this podcast. That's nuts. The Jeremiah Love one was one for me. I saw Eric Berry do some otherworldly things during his playing career at Tennessee. Cordarrelle Patterson, who had a long NFL career between the Vikings and Bears and Falcons in his lone season at Tennessee, he took a toss sweep at Georgia when Georgia was a top 10, maybe top 5 team, and he ran the completely wrong way and ended up literally evading all 11 Georgia defenders for like a 54-yard touchdown on a toss sweep that was a busted play. Again, I want to reiterate, because the play was designed to go left, and he took the pitch and immediately ran right. And there's some other funny stories there that we can hash out over off the air some point, just at the uniqueness of Cordarrelle Patterson, many of them not fit for public airwaves. But for me, that my best golf feat would be I got to play the Knoxville Open a few years ago, the Pro-Am golf tournament, and we had a PGA Tour carded golf pro with us. His name escapes me. He had played at Illinois. He had been like a standout, maybe All-American, certainly All-Conference at Illinois, and had his PGA Tour card. And on the eighth hole at Fox Den and Knox Country Club, I outdrove him and our entire group. And so, like, I was so stunned by it. This is the honest to God's true story. I mean, I piped that ball as good as I've ever hit any drive, and I'm a terrible golfer. That we get to the ninth hole, and they all hit, and I was going last. And I was like, all right, boys, let's go. And they're like, you had long drive last hole. And I was like, there are only so many of those shots in this bag. Let's keep moving. And so that's probably my best.
In terms of witnessing another one, Sean Kemp in high school getting the opening tip and smacking it off the side wall of Marion's gym. I just want you to envision any gym you've ever been in and someone jumps up and just for the sake of intimidating everybody in the world, smacking the opening tip off the sidewall instead of just tipping it to one of his teammates. And Sean Kemp, he had a lot of those type of things.
He did it in the NBA too.
Yeah, he did too. He could probably smack a few balls in the NBA as well. Next question from Otzer Poll. A coworker of mine thinks KVA is overrated. That coworker should not be your friend. When I told him he was wrong, we looked up his sack totals, which did not look that impressive. Is this all about his pressures? Help me convince my coworker KVA is a top tier player on the ND roster when healthy.
I guess I don't understand. Is a friend just saying he's not a good pass rusher? Is that why they looked at that? Because I think the whole reason he's great is because he can do everything. He's not an edge rusher, but he's still up there in pressures and sacks. And he's also probably their best linebacker in coverage last year. He can do it all. He's like great against the run. He's still 6'3", maybe 6'4", 235 pounds. Like, he has no weakness. And he's a guy in an era where Notre Dame even is primary nickel defense. You don't have to take him off the field. There's ways to keep him on the field and potentially keep linebackers on, because he has no weakness. And he's not even like, he's maybe not as good in coverage as like Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah was, but he's also way bigger and can do a lot of other different things. And you can still put him against a tight end in the slot.
And Wu didn't have the same level of colleague when he was playing at Notre Dame. So he had to play a lot more and he had to play a lot earlier. I don't think you can overstate at all the impact of KVA's teammates as to his limited production. He is a part of what I think is the single best linebacking core in America right now. The kid at Texas Tech that went pro, Rodriguez, last year, that was so good. Name me another Texas Tech linebacker from last year. Glasker, the kid at BYU, I think number 16, that I think is really, really good, who's back this year. I don't know another linebacker at BYU, not right now. You can, not just because you're a Notre Dame fan, I feel like we just saw Drake Bowen getting honor All-American honors today from Phil Steele. We've seen other guys at that position, certainly not just KVA. So I think that I'm a big stats guy. Otzerpool, I hope you're a supervisor and maybe you can put this guy in timeout at work. But, you know, I don't think everything that KVA does or everything that makes him elite and has made the Notre Dame coaches themselves say they expect him to be a first-round NFL draft pick, I'll always defer to those who are smarter than me.
Yeah, they're going to have a lot of shared statistics on Notre Dame's defense. That's just the way a great defense operates. That's why when you say, someone asks if Boubacar Traore will have this many sacks, I don't know how many he'll have. He'll be really good at rushing the passer, and maybe other people will be getting sacks while he's pressuring a quarterback. That's kind of how it goes with the best teams.
Our next question is from 3i Atlas. Do you have any visibility on where Notre Dame's NIL money is coming from beyond the approved revenue sharing? Do you have a ballpark guess on the breakdown between corporate partners, local businesses, and private donors?
It's heavy corporate partners. Like, I don't know if you, I'm not going to put a percentage on it, but I mean, it's predominant corporate partners. And once you get beyond the rev share, and I would remind you, we're 8 days after Pete Bavakwa just went on Capitol Hill and provided testimony to the Senate about how there's no salary cap in college athletics right now. There's no spend limit in college athletics right now. So that lets you know where Notre Dame is from an investment standpoint. But I like questions like this because they make me try to be better at my job. So thanks for that. And so I did some digging after O'Malley told me this was going to be on the podcast earlier in the week. And what I found out was from some people with direct knowledge is that in addition to Under Armour, and I would note Under Armour, I think in January, announced Joey O'Brien as an Under Armour athlete. Like, that was not an accident. He was already headed to Notre Dame at that point. Tennessee right now is using Adidas aggressively in its recruiting efforts, particularly as it pertains to number one running back prospect David Gabriel Georges. But the other one that I didn't realize, apart from Under Armour, is Peacock, and specifically the Here Come the Irish documentary. Again, from people with direct knowledge of the situation, they say that Notre Dame derives a great deal of revenue that it is then able to structure player contracts to benefit from that. And they're featured in it, so it makes complete sense. It's just a new layer of college athletics that we haven't experienced before. But it's highly corporate, highly corporate. And then beyond that, it's specifically with Under Armour and most notably Peacock and the Here Come the Irish documentary.
They may not make their efforts public, but Notre Dame's efforts in NIL from the moment before they signed Sam Hartman to now is an astoundingly impressive change. And it's why they're number one in the futures market for Rittenberg. That's also a very big part of it as well. But that, I mean, they used to be like Michael Mayer was afraid to talk about it. And he had NIL deals. You know, now, nowadays, if you know someone has, and Jeremiah Love was happy to talk about those things. Like, it was just a different world back then. And I know, you know, you're not going to publish on their student athlete privacy. It's up to them to talk about it. But they were clearly told not to talk about it in the past. And I don't think that's the case.
Well, and worth noting that Jeremiah Love just recently did an interview out in Arizona where he said that basically he made so much money in college, he's not going to have to spend any money off of his rookie contract. And so you did find like a New Balance that Notre Dame helped facilitate that. That's, again, legitimate third-party NIL, but that's a huge private sector company that has a very visible profile that helped Jeremiah Love make several million dollars last year, and only a small portion of which technically came from Notre Dame rev share. So
probably a little different than Jack Cohn, his picture in a Core Life menu when you walk in at South Bend.
It takes all kinds. Question number 7 from East Tex 903. Among past and current Notre Dame players, which guys had the skill sets to potentially be better at a different position than the one they played? For example, based on his high school tape, Kyren Williams had all the traits to be a nasty nickel. T.O., let's open the floor with you.
I was going to open to Drew if you have a current list, because I'll do the old school list, the old time list, because there's a lot of them back then.
I mean, I guess for current players, my biggest one would still be Dallas Golden. As much as I liked what he did as a freshman at nickel and cornerback, I think he could be really special, especially on this team that hasn't be special at wide receiver, especially on the team that we're still looking for more options there. I think when I watched his high school tape, like, he's really athletic, explosive, long. I think there's a lot of different ways you could have used him on the other side of the ball. And from past players, I always thought Jerry Tillery could have been better at tackle if he'd stuck there. I know he's a first round pick, but if you're looking at the like long-term projection of his professional career, I know he's still kind of sticking around in the league, but I don't think he's had quite the level of success. Whereas I think he could have been a really high paid offensive tackle if he had stuck it out there.
That's a good call. I did not even write down Tillery's name. That's really good. Present guy, I highlighted one fairly obvious one. Tay Johnson could play wide receiver for Notre Dame because he could also play basketball for Notre Dame. Kyle Hamilton could have played wide receiver at Notre Dame, especially in the red zone, as often talked about on Twitter. All right, I have an outside-the-box one for you on the current team. If this were the late 1980s and early 1990s when run-stuffing monster linebackers ruled supreme, James Flanagan, the tight end, 6'6", 250, same size as Wes Pritchett, Notre Dame's starting middle linebacker on the national championship team. But I don't think James Flanagan would run to chase down a lot of people in the modern spread era. But boy, James Flanagan's a tough dude that could run and hit back in the day. Any current ones for you, JB, before we get into the famous Holtz era?
No, I don't think so. I tried to think about it. There's certainly some guys there with positional versatility. Sean Sevillano, maybe at guard instead of on the defensive line, comes to mind. Maybe he doesn't quite move well enough. You know, he wouldn't have been better, obviously, because he's, as long as he stays healthy, he's on a trajectory for an all-time career. But it's funny to remember Joe Alt came in basically as a tight end.
And, wouldn't have been better, but you're right.
He was really freaking athletic. And, you know, you wonder, Blake Fisher, could he have been better at guard than tackle? But those are very similar positions. So that's kind of where I was with that.
Obvious one real quick is just Lorenzo Styles played receiver at Notre Dame and then was drafted in the NFL at defensive back from Ohio State.
And he very briefly moved over at defensive back at Notre Dame, but didn't stick there. All right. Well, the Holtz era, Jeff Burris, first round draft pick at safety, was also scored 10 touchdowns as a running back and punt returner. Jeff Burris could have been, he just came 5 years later. He could have started at Notre Dame running back, but he had to contend with all the people that were there, like Bettis, Brooks, Becton, and everybody else. Tom Carter moved, was an option quarterback in high school, went to corner, became a first-round draft pick. Willie Clark played running back and safety at Notre Dame, a little better at running back at Notre Dame, but he became a fourth-round pick at safety in the NFL, so that's awfully impressive. CJ Procise for BK was a scout team safety turned good wide receiver, turned second-round draft pick at running back. Theoretic famously went from running back to slot for Brian Kelly. Once again, they didn't have as much talent, but that gave him a very long NFL career. And then guys that were bad at their previous positions, they're not bad, just not great. Pat Terrell, most famous story of Lou Holtz is Pat Terrell went from wide receiver that dropped the ball all the time to All-American safety, second round pick. Frank Stams couldn't get on the field at fullback. It seems weird he would be a fullback ever. First team All-American at defensive end. And Andy Heck was a tight end, not a bad one, but Andy Heck was a tight end that played 15 years at tackle after converting to Notre Dame. So they used to do it a lot back in the day.
The last name I would bring up would be Xavier Watts, because he was jettisoned from side to side for 3 years. And coaches on both sides of the ball were fighting to keep him on their side of the ball. Like Tommy Reese wanted to keep X as part of his offense.
I was just going to add the Pat Terrell quote about Pat Terrell from the Catholics vs. Convicts doc from Lou Holtz. I think it was to Tony Rice, who passed in the ball and he dropped it, and he yelled at Tony Rice for thinking to throw the ball to him.
Yeah, that's fantastic. That is absolutely tremendous. I mean, to become an All-American safety like that, that's good job. That doesn't always work out. Bobby Taylor was a freshman All-American safety becoming a true All-American corner. I'm not sure that's the same thing, but well, it's pretty hard to do. It'd be hard for Kyle Hamilton. I know Kyle Hamilton can play every position in the NFL, but it'd be hard for Kyle Hamilton to have gone from safety to corner at Notre Dame and be the best corner in the country. So there's some versatility for Bobby Taylor. All right, our next question. I'm going to go down the list for these. From Maltese Irish, award these superlatives using only the current roster. Most likely player to have a touchdown catch or run on SportsCenter's top 10.
I went Devin Fitzgerald or Quincy Porter. Quincy Porter because he's 6'9" wingspan.
I'm going Aeneas Williams or CJ Carr. Because CJ Carr runs a little better than we think. And I could see CJ Carr having legs on a play that maybe he's diving into the end zone or he has an improbable bounce off of a defender and he ends up on SportsCenter top 10.
I had Aeneas Williams and Faison because they will pinball off so many people. There's going to be a broke six tackles on the way to this touchdown type of thing out of those guys. Just won't be every play like Love. And also, Jaden Greathouse has been on this before for international championship games, so we should probably give him his props once in a while, as we are contractually obligated every podcast in the summer to mention his name. Most likely player to become a coach.
Anthony Knapp.
I said Anthony Knapp too. Good job, Drew.
Yeah, I mean, I think just the way he kind of commands respect and his attitude, and I think he has kind of laid back but really gravitational personality that I think he will have an NFL career, but I could see him being a good coach.
Yeah, I mean, I could see CJ Carr getting into coaching. Certainly it's in the bloodlines whenever his long, long playing career is over. Also think that Adon Shuler and Leonard Moore both have some of those coaching traits as well. Drake Bowen as well, big time. And Luke Talich. Sorry, I've done that thing where we name half the damn roster.
That's a good call, Luke.
But Talich. I believe in all of those guys. Yeah, quit nodding your head, Jack.
Most likely player to have a decade long NFL career. Let's just say CJ Carr and then move on.
Yeah, I went CJ Carr.
Yeah, all right. I have Otzer pulls back KVA.
Bravo.
Most likely to be flagged for giving someone the business. And if people don't remember that, it is if you just Google giving someone the business NFL, you will have the highlight of your day to make you smile.
One on each side of the ball. I'll go Anthony Knapp on the offensive side of the ball and Boubacar Traore on the defensive side of the ball.
Went Adon Shuler.
That's good. I went Adon Shuler on defense and I went Cooper Flanagan on offense because that dude's ready to go. He is the guy there. And it could be Faison. I just want to say Faison for every answer. All right. Favorite one. Most likely to have an elaborate celebration after a big play.
I'm going Mylon Graham on offense and Tay Johnson on defense.
That's good on defense.
I think that's a good one. I struggle with this a little bit. I went Jalen Snead on defense.
That's a good one as well. I'm not going to question any of those. I like the immediate go to the Ohio State guy there, JB. That's showing your true fandom. Also, I'm going to change it a little just because I'm reading the question. It's at the end. Instead of elaborate celebration, I believe most likely to have a elaborate personal foul penalty for incessant trash talk in a rivalry game, possibly on November 7th after a touchdown, is CJ Carr, because he is apparently reaching legendary trash talking proportions.
What you didn't know is that VA Doc set betting lines on this, and the over-under Mylon Graham references was one.
Nice.
Or point five. So point I had five. To make that a winning bet.
Nice. Our next question from Backer Tiki. How has the NIL, the portal, the modern college football landscape affected your love of college football? We're probably going to save this for a 6-person panel, but we're going to use it right here anyway.
I think it's getting to the point where it could have an adverse effect just because things are getting so chaotic. But I think, honestly, that the fact that the players can now get paid has made it more enjoyable for me, just from the standpoint that, I mean, there's like less skill. I think they're obviously a hugely profitable business. So I think the chaos is getting a little bit too much right now, and I'm not sure exactly what the resolution or the stabilizing force will be at this point. But I do think overall, especially from Notre Dame's perspective, where the transfer portal isn't this mass exodus and things aren't too crazy right now for that, I think overall it's still been a positive impact on my appreciation for the game, but I'm not sure that will be the case in a year or two.
Yeah, I think for me, it's not really impacted my love for college football. I'm a sports writer because of my love for college football. I will say, like, the Brendan Sorsby situation is a stomach turner for sure, and having to spend so much time and effort covering it right now, and there's more developments coming today. So having to deal with all of that is certainly hampering my enjoyment of the job. And as someone who started out covering the Lady Vols basketball very early in my journalism career, I do have an appreciation for women's athletics and the non-revenue sports because of how hard those people work, and the fact that I've gotten to become friends with some former Notre Dame swimmers and track athletes and tennis and all of that. And that's in real jeopardy. So I worry about that, but it hasn't affected really my love for college football at all.
NIL and portal has greatly impacted my love of college basketball that I used to love. It's a real big deal. It's made it worse. I jokingly, this is a joke, the first thing that did it was allowing players to go earn a living and go pro early, because my television was better when they had to stay through their junior years or sophomore years. Once going pro from high school and one and done, you just don't know the players or the teams as much. Obviously, I believe they should be able to go pro when they want to go pro, third living. But it's a lot more fun when Duke had Christian Laettner there for 4 years to hate. You like people when you get familiarity, either breeds contempt or you enjoy watching them because you become a fan of those guys. So basketball has been going downhill for a while. The portal in basketball is, NIL is just bad for Notre Dame, but the portal in basketball is just so hard. I mean, I grew an appreciation for Connecticut just because I kept some people to watch those two championships in a row. And of course, they're great for betting. As we said, we will talk about betting, if not Sorsby. College football, the Sorsby thing is, I mean, letting him play is just ridiculous. But like, I got over Michigan openly cheating and winning a national title. Not good, but I still enjoyed college football the next year. Do you guys remember what happened the next year in college football? We got to travel around a lot and have some fun in January. I had a great time with that. So it hasn't affected it badly yet. I don't mind at all. I mean, it's stupid to call it NIL. It's pay for play. Dumb to call it NIL. You're not getting name, image, and likeness when you're a freshman no one's ever heard of making $75,000 to show up on campus for $100,000. But I don't care. It's their money. I'm still fine with it. And I agree with JB, and Priester said this before. It's the other sports that are going to suffer for the largesse of college football. But we like college football. Final question. AeroFan624. I thank him for asking a couple times. If you could add one amenity to the Notre Dame press box and you had an unlimited budget, what would it be? I didn't read the unlimited budget part first. That's different. Anything, JB?
Notre Dame's elite. They take beyond good care of the media, certainly much better care of us than we deserve. So I don't have a whole, like LSU and a couple of other spots. Maybe even USC did this a couple of years ago. We'll occasionally put out, well, LSU I think does it after every home game, puts out iced coolers of tall boys. So, you know, there are worse ways to walk to walk to your car in the parking lot, or in my case, the wonderful JLB usually picks me up. So there would be worse ways to walk to your car than with a cold beverage in hand.
I think one thing, I mean, this isn't that big a deal, but there's always a mad dash to get to the like press rooms off the side for us to record instant analysis or things like that. So just, I mean, if I had an unlimited budget to expand it out so there's even more room, so I'm not dealing with, there's certain people who must be leaving before the game is over and just waiting outside those rooms to get in there. So I feel like it's a little, that would be nice. I'm also always cold, so just knowing some way I could be warm, I don't know how to do that without disrupting everyone else except for myself, but maybe just a section where I knew they weren't going to open the window in November.
Unlimited boxes of hand and feet warmers.
Yes.
The best part about this is I am the person that loves the windows open the most in the entire press box, and I sit next to Drew. So we have to find that photo of Yankee Stadium where I'm just sitting there in my shirt sleeve, my long sleeve shirt, and you're completely covered in a parka and scarf trying to type in the press box. That's awesome. Drew, just get your own office. Just pay for your own office, and you can do that.
There we go.
I don't know. JB's right. Notre Dame takes great care of us in terms of like any reasonable amenity that you're going for. But yeah, I'll tell you what. If I could pay for it, I'd pay for a spot to be able to walk down and with 5 minutes left and walk all around the stadium to watch the game like I do everywhere else. I would like to have that pass. Used to be able to go downstairs and walk around the stadium and watch the last 5 minutes of the game. Go to the side where you get great stories when there were goal line stands. I was standing on the goal line when Ben Koyak scored the touchdown to beat Stanford. Standing on the goal line for the goal line stand 2 years before against Stanford. Standing on the goal line when CJ Procise got called for the flag that took away the Florida State winning touchdown. That I miss. So if I had unlimited funds, I would buy that pass to be that very cool guy that walks around and pretends to take pictures of stuff and do that.
And we were on the opposite end zone when 10 men were on the field against Ohio State, so none of us could see. So that, to your point, it also detracts greatly from our ability to do our job at times too.
So outside the press box, that's my only complaint. There we go. I assume nobody else has any complaints, and if so, we will end this podcast today. We'll be back on Monday, June 15th, for another edition of Irish Illustrated Insider. This one was very fun. For Drew Mentock of Irish Illustrated, John Bryce of USA Today, who might have some stuff to write about in the next coming days, I am Tim O'Malley. Thank you for watching and listening, Irish Illustrated Insider.